Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, and welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival 2021 podcast edition. My name is Claire Wright, and I'm a Professor of History at La Trobe University in Melbourne. It is my great pleasure to be your host for this session, where I'll be in conversation with two wonderful authors, Larissa Berendt and Stephen Carroll, on the topic of What's Left Unsaid. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that I'm coming to you from the stolen land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation and that their sovereignty was never ceded. I pay my respects to elders past and present and thank them for their hospitality in allowing me to live and work on their country here today. I'd like to extend that respect to other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might be listening to this podcast. This country that we call Australia always was and always will be Aboriginal land. So let me now introduce Larissa and Stephen to you. Distinguished Professor Larissa Berendt, OA, is the Director of Research at the Jumbana Indigenous House of Learning at the University of Technology, Sydney. She has an LLB and B Juris from UNSW and an LLM and SJD from Harvard Law School. That's a lot of letters, Larissa. Larissa is a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences of Australia and a Foundation Fellow of the Australian Academy of Law. Apart from her stellar legal and academic credentials, Larissa holds numerous board and community positions, including being Chair of the Cathy Freeman Foundation and a Trustee of the Australian Museum. But that's not all. Larissa is also an award-winning filmmaker and host of Speaking Out on ABC Radio. In 2020, she received an Order of Australia for distinguished service to Indigenous education and research, to the law and to the visual and performing arts. And for our purposes today, she's also an award-winning writer of both fiction and non-fiction. Larissa's novels include Home, which won the Queensland Premier's Literary Awards, the David Unipun Award, and the Commonwealth Writers Prize for Best First Novel in the Southeast Asian South Pacific region in 2005. Her second novel, Legacy, won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Indigenous Writing in 2010. And her latest novel is the simply exquisite After Story, published by UQP, which we'll be discussing today. Welcome, Larissa.
Thank you.
Stephen Carroll is the multi-award-winning author of 12 novels, including A World of Other People, which was the joint winner of the 2014 Prime Minister's Literary Award, and The Time We Have Taken, which was the winner of the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for the Southeast Asia and Pacific region, and it also won the coveted Miles Franklin Award in 2008. Forever Young was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award and the Prime Minister's Literary Award in 2016, and A New England Affair was shortlisted for the Victorian Premier's Literary Award in 2018. His novels are often grouped into the Glenroy series and the Elliot Quartet. His most recent novel fits into neither of those categories. It is simply called O. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Claire.
Larissa, I'd like to start with you. Firstly, congratulations on this book. After Story is a truly beautiful, complex and deeply ambitious book, and I endured every page of it. I actually listened to it also as the audio book, and I can guarantee listeners that I'm not sure who the actors or the voices were on that, but they've just done a fantastic job of it. So the theme for our session is how literature from long ago can lead us to truths once unsaid. Can you firstly take us through the setup of After Story, the frankly brilliant premise of two Indigenous women making a pilgrimage to England to discover the canon of English literature? How did you arrive at this narrative framework?
Yeah, thanks, Claire. For me, I guess it felt like there were a number of things that setting the novel in this space would do for me. And I really did want to, in the background, be comparing both the storytelling tradition of my own First Nations culture with the literary canon that I grew up with and really loved. So for me, it was very important that I paid respect to both of those. So there was that element of it. And I liked a way of interrogating more deeply too the tensions that I think are universal between a generation that has the advantages of education that the previous generation didn't have. And I think that's been very much the experience of my generation, where there was a group of us, including women like Anita Heiss and Terry Janke, who were all at university together, that first kind of wave coming through, given these enormous opportunities that our parents weren't given. But I think through Della, Jasmine's mother, who's the character who's kind of embracing that generation or represents it, getting to see a different view and a different idea of the world, a different worldview. And I guess for me, just I think whether you travel overseas for a brief period of time or you live there for a period of time, I think one thing that becomes really apparent is for everything you learn about the place where you're at, you learn so much about yourself. And it felt to me like it was something interesting to explore. And I loved the idea of turning on its head the idea that, you know, the colonials come over here to Australia to try and understand the natives. And in fact, we have our two First Nations women going over to try and understand these colonisers. And I think through Della's eyes, we certainly get a really kind of frank First Nations view of that. So it did a lot of things. And, of course, the final thing it did, I did do some of those kind of trips with my mum when I was much younger. We never did the literary tour. I had to kind of make that up. And my husband and I did that ourselves just to make sure it would all work. But I did do those kinds of tours with her. I had have a very good relationship with my mum. I don't think that helps when you're in those kind of situations. But it seemed to me it was a place to really put characters where they couldn't escape from each other. You are, when you're in those get on the bus, get off the bus kind of tours, you're kind of confining your characters. So there was actually some thematic reasons for it, and then some structural narrative ones as well.
So that clears up something for me, because I did notice in your acknowledgements that you had done the tour, but you did that after you'd written the book, not as a kind of prompt to writing the book.
Well, yeah, I had some ideas. I did do it early on, but I had already got the idea of doing it rather than it coming out of that. But I have to say there were parts then when I came back to write them that I really struggled with. Lewis Carroll, who I gets a small mention in Stephen's book as well, but, you know, the Oxford part of the trip was very hard. I felt like almost wanting to go back and finish it, but COVID wouldn't let me. I thought maybe I'd get some extra inspiration. So I did really have to do a lot of it from memory. But luckily I was good at collecting lots of things, taking lots of photographs, writing lots of notes. So I felt like I could go back there in other ways.
Just as Della does, taking notes as well. And I want to go back to the Oxford scene actually later on in our discussion. Stephen, if I could turn to you, your book also takes us to the old world, but this time to continental Europe, to Second World War-torn France. And you explore another work of literature that is entered into the canon, but not exactly in the same way as Jane Austen or the Bronte sisters, as Larissa discovers on her literary tour. So tell us, who is the eponymous O in the title of your book? How did you find her, and why did you want to resurrect her at this point in time?
Her name is Dominique Henri, and she wrote the scandalous novel, Story of O. And I was just finishing, I was just about to begin my third novel, which became The Love Song of Lucy McBride. And I knew there'd be erotic scenes in it. And they're incredibly difficult to write. You know, one wrong move and you're into sort of cliche or mere function. And so somebody directed me to Anais Nin and said, you should read her stories. And so I went to a bookshop and I bought her stories. Alongside Anais Nin, The Story of O. Now, I'd heard about it, but I knew it was scandalous, but I hadn't actually read it. And then came this really interesting article in The New Yorker by John de Saint-Jour about the person who actually wrote the book. It was a fascinating article. And that's when I got interested. But I didn't actually read Story of O until later on. And what struck me when I read it was not so much the erotics of the text itself, but rather this constant repetition of key words like surrender and submission and defeat and humiliation and shame and liberty and masters and foreign forces and captivity. It's not even a novel, really. I'm waving my arms about now as I talk, so I'm getting into my stride, even though I'm invisible. It's probably about 40,000 words, but these words just kept coming back again and again and again. And I eventually came to the conclusion that what was actually going on in this book? No, it's a kind of unconscious metaphor for the most shameful phase in modern French history. That is the occupation of France, and that's why it's O for occupation. And it's quite interesting in the sense that had Story of O been written 20 years after the occupation, it wouldn't have mattered. But the fact is, it was conceived of and written in the rain shadow of the occupation, when everybody's nerves were jangled, everybody was in deep denial. Suddenly everybody had been in the resistance, which is simply not true. To an extent, it was the very book that the French people did not want to have published at that the worst time, not just because it's scandalous, erotics in it, because I think it also jangled a lot of, it stirred a people in deep denial of their history. So in this sense, it's a kind of, I think you can say, it's a legitimately a deconstruction of Story of O, in the sense that it seeks to actually find the absent present in the book. Now, there's always a sort of absent presence. Larissa, in her book, her wonderful book, talks about Mansfield Park when they tour around Jane Austen territory. And, you know, there's that famous essay, I think it's Edward Said, who said that the absent present in that text was the West Indian sugar plantations, the very thing that makes the lifestyle of Mansfield Park possible. Now, I'm arguing that the absent presence in Story of O is the occupation itself. She unconsciously took the history out of her tale and presents it as a dark fantasy. I put the history back in and contextualised all of that submission, suffering, humiliation, shame, etc. And I could go on quite a bit about this, but it's one of those cases where the psyche of the author is like the psyche of the country writ large, and it doesn't happen very often.
Again, Stephen, you preempted a question that I'm going to come back to later on in terms of the French psyche. Larissa, in fact, both of you have the word story in your title, After Story and the Story of O. And both of your books deal with the way that story making and storytelling is both a constructive but also a destructive act, the way that privileging certain stories buries other stories. So, Larissa, there's a scene where Jasmine and Della are in Oxford. They are touring the Bodleian Library and its famous manuscripts, including a Magna Carta. And Jasmine admits that books and words and documents have been her, and I'm quoting here, her lifeline, her escape. But she also remembers something that Auntie Elaine has said, and that is that, again quoting, the silences are as important as the words. There is what's not in the archive, not in the history books. Those things that have been excluded, hidden, overlooked. Tell me about the role that Auntie Elaine plays in your book and the significance of the sorts of truths that she reveals.
It felt to me like I really wanted to, in some ways, pay homage to those deep storytellers and that those holders of great wisdom that Auntie Elaine represents. And the silences are more important than the words is one of my kind of favourite kind of sayings that elders talk about. And the other one is that true knowledge comes from listening, not speaking. And, both encourage contemplation. They're not passive activities. They're about deep listening and trying to really understand what you're looking at. And for me, it felt like it was important when I created the character of Annie Elaine that one of the elements of the book is that she's passed, because it becomes a kind of warning of ignoring that history while it's still with us and what we do lose, which is one of the things that both Jasmine and Della grapple with, is now that they haven't done enough of that listening, how do they put the pieces back together? And Annie Elaine also plays a role through storytelling and the stories that she's handed down and how both women come back to them in different ways to work through their own issues. She continues to play the role that those matriarchs play in our community, which is keeping that cohesiveness together, keeping the social fabric together. So even in her absence, she's able to play that role. And for me, I think it's one of the things that in Stephen's book so deeply resonates with me. Not only do you run the risk of losing that, if you do not pay honour to those stories and keep those stories, you run the risk that those stories get lost, and you run the risk that the counter-narrative that doesn't care for those stories will be dominant. And, you know, I think Stephen explores that very much in the way a different country has to come to terms with its own narrative it tells itself about a shameful part of history. And I feel like there's a very similar thing that happens with the characters in my book, that there is a part of the embracing the heritage of storytelling, the 65,000 plus years tradition of oral storytelling, that becomes very urgent when you have an aggressive colonizer that's so good with words.
And Stephen, there's a different kind of silencing that Dominique has to live with. Not the narrative dispossession wrought by colonization, but by gender. In your account, Dominique writes her sordid tales of what lies beneath the veneer of respectable femininity in order to impress her much older male lover, who doesn't believe that a woman could ever write the sort of stories that he would himself like to read. So she writes him that story, and then she tells him, and in her words, she tells him of the blindfold, the tied hands, O's surrender and submission, her defeat and humiliation, all of which she endures to please her lover, strangely proud and resolute all the while. What she does willingly and for love. So I'm curious, is Dominique's book an authentic version of her truth, or a kind of punitive ventriloquist's act, an attempt to beat the oppressor at his own game? Has Dominique herself, in fact, been colonised?
I think all are true. Yes to all questions. It's a highly complex situation, and she is a highly complex person. I mean, this is somebody who this is enormously sophisticated intelligence, Dominique Ory, and that wasn't even her name. She always liked the clandestine life. She always liked secrecy. She always liked being in the shadows. And to an extent, it actually played to her strengths, I think, what actually took place. But when the challenge was offered to her, she took it on full on, but at the same time, she is to an extent taking on the patriarchy, but she's also assuming much of patriarchal assumption. So on the one hand, she's actually countering the prevailing patriarchal ideology that says a woman couldn't write a book like this, but at the same time, she is also being part of it too. So there is that sort of ambivalence. And ambivalence is a really key word running through a lot of what she writes about. She never really wanted the story to be published. It was Jean Paulhan who insisted that he thought it was so good that it should be published. And, of course, for a long, long time, everybody simply assumed it was written by a man. So then you've got this sort of whole, because it would seem to be playing up to male fantasy, whereas she maintained it wasn't. She was simply maintaining that was her fantasy. And she was also saying that for her there was a metaphor running through the whole thing, which was basically a religious metaphor. She was very much influenced by Fenelon, the French 17th century quietist and novelist and bishop as well, and which is basically quietism. It was all about the loss of the self the annihilation of the self. And she always claimed that what her character O was doing was actually in the process of annihilating the self in search of enlightenment and then thereby unifying herself with God or something like that. But the running through the whole thing, I think all your questions were right. Running through the whole thing is the ambivalence of the whole project. On the one level, she is pandering to male fantasy. On another level, she's actually countering it because she would maintain that there's a very complex dynamic going on in the story between her and the masters in the castle. They would seem to be in charge, but Dominic Ory always maintained that they only had the illusion of being in charge. And there's a scene in the book which I deliberately put in because she's looking, Dominic Ory, and that wasn't her real name. Her real name is Anne Duclos. And then when she published under a pseudonym, Story of O, that was Pauline Rayarch. So, and she had lots of other names as well. Dominic Ory was her resistance name. But anyway, there's one spot, and I'll be very quick about this, where she's looking into a shop window and she sees her reflection. And it's after the scandal has hit. It takes their breath away, but it is so scandalous. And she's looking in the shop window and she's saying, and she just looks like somebody's aunt, you know, and she's saying to herself, "You frighten them. Now, why do you frighten them? What do you do in this work that would seem so much to be pandering to male fantasy? Is it actually attacking it at the same time? And are both correct?"
I love that idea of a resistance name. I think we should all have a resistance name. Steve, I'm going to stick with you for a minute and push that point a little further. You mentioned the love song of Lucy McBride earlier, which is the first of your books that I read, and I absolutely adored it. I remember sitting on a park bench, unable to keep moving on to the meeting I was supposed to go to until I'd actually finished the book. And I've always felt that the most charismatic and compelling characters in your books are the women. So in this sense, O is the book that you were meant to write. But what are the politics of an Australian cis man writing in the voice of a French woman, and in particular about her desires, her passions, her deepest, darkest sexual urges? How are you able to get at O's truth?
First of all, I was quite anxious about this book because of those points. And also it's such a scandalous book too. And I hummed and hawed for about 10 years about writing this book, but I eventually thought, I think the idea is strong enough. There's only one way to find out if the idea has the legs to actually produce a novel. So I went to it. Now, I was either innocent or I was presumptuous or a mixture of the both, but I felt that I could actually get into the character. And I think what allowed me into the book and into the story was the thesis that informs the book. And from there, I actually could move into the character. Now, there is presumption involved. I guess in the end, the only way to actually address this is to say, well, you know, ultimately the reader will decide if they think it works or it doesn't work. It was part and parcel of my anxiety about the book because it was not just a foreign culture, but you had to go deeply into a female character. Now, I've never actually been frightened about writing about women. And we talked about this in Sydney when we had another panel. And I come from a long line of very strong women in the family. The matriarchs were always, you know, the strong figures. The men were always pretty absent, you know. And I've been lucky enough to know some fairly wonderful women in life who've taught me a lot. And so I've never actually been afraid of actually writing a female character. Now, that may be arrogance. It may be innocence. I don't know. But I've never actually felt that it was any more a challenge than writing a male character. And I think, because, you know, we get to know each other, don't we? You know, it's not as though, you know, it's not as though it's a sort of foreign species, you know. We do through life get to know each other, and we do get to know the inner workings of our psyches and the contradictions and the paradoxes. And we're very complex beings. And I like that. I like going into that. I like going into the paradoxes, the contradictions. I like, I think this is where the novel really shines, and it shines not in certainty, but it shines in uncertainty. It shines when it's going into, in ambivalence. I think that's when the novel really comes to life, for me anyway. It's not about stating something specifically and certainly. It helps us to go into the highly complex nature of these beings that we are. Now, look, I'm rambling a bit there. I'm sorry about this, but let's just say that, in summary, that if a character feels strong, and if character calls, I simply go with the character, whether it's a male character or a female character. It doesn't bother me.
Well, it certainly worked for me in this book, Stephen. And I've got to say as well that it shines in the sex scenes, which you bring all that complexity to bear on the physical intimacy, and they are amongst the best written passages of the book. Larissa, your story, if we stick with this theme of voice, I guess, is told through the dovetailed narrative of two distinct voices. Della, a traumatised mother doing the best she can with a pretty rotten hand she's been dealt in life, and Jasmine, her daughter, who is determined to escape the systemic racism and family confines of her small town life. And I think both voices come across as entirely plausible and compelling. I'm wondering whether, for you, one of these women speaks the truth more than the other, or speaks to the truth. Which is the more reliable witness?
Well, I'll get into that. I just want to also say that I found Stephen's portrayal incredibly convincing too. So that's two votes for it. And
thank you very much, Gary.
Look, and it was an interesting thing. Obviously, Jasmine is much more, her life is much more like mine, but I actually found it easier to write Della's voice. I guess because she was such an amalgam of some women who've been so instrumental in my life, I could hear their voices really strongly. How she speaks is exactly how they do. So I felt like her voice was always stronger to me. I do feel like it's her novel. There's a thing in screenwriting that we don't so much use as a rule with literature, where it's always the story is that of the person who's changed the most from the beginning of it to the end. And in this sense, I think it is Della. And I sort of feel like, for me, what she comes into in terms of her journey through this book is, once she starts to take on the role of storyteller, and not with her daughter first, but with the middle-class white woman from Mossman, but in that role that she's never imagined, once she hears her ability to pass on the wisdom that had come to her through Aunty Elaine, she starts to enter in the beginning of her own eldership. So I sort of felt like by the end of the novel, Della has started that part of her life. She's more comfortable in the new cultural role that she has now that Aunty Elaine's passed. Whereas I sort of feel like for Jasmine, she's uncovered some things, but she's still got a long way to go. It was a deliberate choice to have Della confront her reliance on alcohol. But if you read carefully, Jasmine is just as reliant on it, but never confesses to it or faces up. But it was a way of saying she's still got a long way to go. So to that extent, I think I always felt that there was a stronger truth in where Della was, just because how much we value wisdom in our community. And, you know, I think throughout that she gives us the frankest kind of insights. And again, not in a way that deprecates what she's seeing, but just in the way that she privileges what she knows and challenges us to think differently. She challenges Jasmine, she challenges us as readers. So, I have to say, bit of a bias there for Della in that. There were times when I wondered whether it was just her voice and whether it should be a two-voice novel, but it did feel like there were things to be said that I couldn't say through Della.
I thought the structure worked absolutely beautifully. And one of the things that you held in such fine balance was not making Della a kind of village idiot through her naivety, or the fact this is the first time that she had been overseas and that Jasmine was so much more sophisticated on one level than her mother. We never laugh at Della. She holds the floor for us. And interestingly, she holds an audience with the other members of the tour. And I love this part as well. It was almost like a kind of Agatha Christie setup, that you've got this group of people all marooned together in the literary bus. Was it important for you to have those characters who were coming from places other than Australia, and also they weren't English, who were able to kind of be another kind of vector into the particular nature of the storytelling?
They certainly did allow for a complexity in terms of different lens to look through different ideas, particularly for Jasmine, who very much lives in the world of the academy and the professions and the literature. But I like the idea that, in a way, that you can learn all of those things that Jasmine learns from books. The sort of wisdom that Della has can't be learned that way. And I like it was a deliberate choice that Jasmine's almost the last person who sees Della that way, that everyone else sees. Lionel sees it probably before anyone else. Meredith sees it. And in a way, it was that thing about us, perhaps we never value what's closest to us, and there was that bit. And it did feel like there was never any chance of her being in a position where she'd be mocked because I loved her too much. And I think that's what resonates with me, with what Stephen says about how you trust the characters you're creating, even if they're a different worldview or a different place from you, because I think you have such a deep relationship with them, a love relationship, maybe sometimes a love-hate relationship. But I think that comes through when you create them and the choices you make. So, yeah, I felt like she had a really important role to play, and putting her up against all of the other types of experts and people who had privileges that she didn't have, which is why we've got the Boston sisters there, who were the only two who were actually based on real people I met on those tours.
Really? Oh, yeah,
they've made a huge impression on me. They've stayed with me all this time. But, you know, that she would hold her own, but in that subtle way of you had to listen deeply to understand the gifts she was giving you.
Okay, well, that segues beautifully into my last question to you, Larissa, and then I'll come back to you for one more, Stephen, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. So, Larissa, back to Auntie Elaine. You've suggested she's kind of a Greek chorus, and a line of hers that I quickly scribbled down in my own notebook, Auntie Elaine says, "You have to be ready to listen." So as you suggested, this book is very close and very personal to you. Does an author have to be ready to tell?
I think there's a feeling with our stories that sometimes it is actually not you as the author, but the story. I find that often with my writing, fiction, nonfiction, filmmaking. There'll be a story I've started to tell, and for different reasons, I can't finish it. And then the time comes when it's ready. For example, Finding Eliza, which actually think in Stephen's book, I felt even more synergy with what I was trying to say there about how somebody tells a story and what story is important to them and what gets them offended tells you much more than just the story itself. Those sorts of ideas in there. But that book, I had a lot of trouble trying to find the voice in it. And it wasn't until the Butchala, who are the traditional owners of Fraser Island, and the book is about the fascination with the Eliza Fraser narrative by white people, that I could wrap the story up. It was almost like they had to finish this part of their story before it was ready to be told. So there is this kind of view within my own culture that stories take their own time. So really, in some ways, you're just a vessel. But there's no doubt this is something that I've seen, you know, when I've seen older Aboriginal people dispensing knowledge to somebody who's asked, And somebody maybe in their own family says, well, Nan, why have you never told me that story? And they'll say, because you weren't ready to hear it. And there is a thing about that, that you have to be ready to hear it, but you also then have to be ready to have this, to take the story and know that the story is going to tell you how it wants to be told. And, you know, I think the more I've tried to develop my craft as a storyteller across mediums, I've come to respect that cultural knowledge more and more. I sometimes feel like I'm at the behest of it. And look, this in a way, this was an interesting thing. I always said this was the least autobiographical book I'd ever written, because the others were so closely influenced by my father and my father's family, where I get my First Nations heritage from. And I was talking to my publisher, you know, a couple of years ago while I was still struggling with the book, and I did my usual spiel about this is the least autobiographic thing I've ever written. And then I suddenly realised it was all about me and my mother. So, and then actually it became a lot easier for me to finish the book. And you know, I think there's a reason why as storytellers a story will draw us. And sometimes, you know, as Stephen says, in terms of what's really interesting about an author, when you kind of try and deconstruct why an author tells a story, there is a subconscious thing that's going on that's deeply relevant. And sometimes the author can say from experience, might not be as aware of that as they should be, but it's all part of that process of how many lives a story has when you tell it.
So, Stephen, the last question to you, let's keep with that.
Can I just jump in very quickly, though?
Yeah, of course.
And say that I agree with what Larissa is saying. And I think to an extent it's important that we actually don't know those underlying psychological factors that we haven't either acknowledged or know about when we're actually writing something, because that's where the charge is. You know, and if we know too much about it, I suspect we're going to lose that sort of lightning charge in the writing. I think often as not, authors do not know a lot about what they're writing. They will know the immediate facts. They will know the immediate springboards that they've leapt off and what has caused the book to come about. But there'll be other things that they will simply not know about. And that's why we've got readers. And that's why if a book has got real resonance and charge, it will live on in a separate life with the reader. And also, just let me say that Della and Jasmine are just fantastic characters. They operate as a yin and a yang. And at some stage, I'd really love to know, Larissa, why you decided to reverse the order. Because it's Della at the beginning and then Jasmine, and then it becomes Jasmine. It's a really interesting maneuver. But what was the question, Claire?
It's a very quick answer too. It's the moment when Della realises she's stepping into Auntie Elaine's shoes and she becomes a confident storyteller. So on that point, maybe Claire should repeat her question.
Look, I'm tempted just to wrap it up there, Stephen, because I think that you've concluded that beautifully. But I just do have one last aspect of my own curiosity about what draws a writer to a particular story. And as you've said before, you thought about writing this story for 10 years, and that you came up with a theory about the nature of post-war French psyche. And that was a theory that you wanted to test in a literary sense. So what I'm curious about is whether that theory requires the distance of the outsider to see it. Is it a historical distance from the event, or a kind of geographical distance from the homeland that gives you that critical insight into France's national psyche? Just maybe a quick answer, and that will also, I think, help us get to this nature of the distances we travel to find ourselves coming home, which is in another sense of theme of Larissa's book.
Yeah, well, as succinctly as possible. When I spoke to people in France, and we've lived in France. I've lived in France. I've spent years and years there. My French is still crap, you know, but because I've spent a lot of time writing there. But I did research this book quite a bit, and I got to meet people like Philippe Soleuse, who was a really famous French author, married to Julia Kristeva, bit of a power couple. I interviewed him inside Gallimard, and he told him about the theory, and I thought they would be quite, you know, sort of affronted and find it very presumptuous, but the French people that I spoke to found it actually very interesting, and often has not said, this is the kind of insight that an outsider brings to a culture that the culture itself can't see. It's a sort of the trees and forests. And that gave me a lot of confidence that there actually might be something in it. And as for history, you know, I became aware of the whole business of denial and a country in denial of its history, drinking the sort of ambrosia of forgetfulness and amnesia. And I became kind of aware that this is actually what's going on here too. This is what Larissa's dealing with, countries in denial of their histories. And perhaps I was actually working that out by looking at another country altogether. Not just the past, which is, you know, a foreign country, but also setting it in a foreign country. And so it's interesting the way these things do work, and the way the imagination works. It's taking you somewhere. There's a truth involved that you're following. You know there is. That's why you're following it. And so you go there and you find out just for you what that truth is when history parts, when the fog lifts and you see what's there.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for the rich, lyrical and intelligent quality of your imaginations. I enjoyed both of these books more than I can tell you, and having the opportunity to discuss them with you today has been a real treat. So thank you both for your generosity and the gifts of your language. And can I urge listeners to read both of these remarkable books? And a reminder that you can purchase any books through the Melbourne Writers Festival's partner bookshop, Readings. Thank you, the listeners, for tuning in and supporting Melbourne Writers Festival. We look forward to seeing you back at live events in 2022. Thanks, Larissa. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.